everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. Before we get to my guests, I want to tell you about HelloFresh, the leading meal delivery kit service. It is delicious and it's easy to make. I can't recommend it highly enough. My wife and I had the pan roasted chicken. Delicious. Dijon mustard sauce, a fresh salad, and it took no time to make it. Like, well, here, ask my wife. Carol, how long did it take to make that chicken dish?
About a half hour.
There you go. Half hour. Unbelievable. And they have all sorts of dishes. They got salmon. They got steak. They got vegetarian. You want it, they got it. Just open the package, cook. It comes freshly sealed. It's amazing. And we're going to give you a special offer because you're listening to this podcast. Go to HelloFresh.com, enter the promo code Paul, and you get $35 off your first week of deliveries. That's a great deal. HelloFresh.com, enter the promo Paul, and you get $35 off your first week of deliveries. You won't regret it. It's delicious. I'm on the road again, December 15th to the 18th at the Omaha Funny Bone, Omaha, Nebraska. Great club. Always have a blast. Really cool people. If you're in the area, come on out. December 15th to the 18th, Omaha Funny Bone, and go to the Omaha Funny Bone website for tickets. Enjoy the podcast.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, buddy. How's everything? You good?
Everything's good. Just running around like a nut today. Yeah. You don't have kids, do you?
Yeah, I got a boy. He's 13. You have Jackson, and is Meredith? Is that the your two?
A boy named Meredith. Yes, named after my father-in-law.
Cool.
And 11 and 2.5 is like the worst age difference in the world.
Oh my God! Yeah. So I'm 10 years apart from my brother and sister. Like I had never had anything in common with them. You know.
Did you like? But you got to be like an only child for a while, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And like at. And I was the third one, so at that point, my parents kind of gave up and, like, whatever you want. They were like, you know what I mean? We'll get going and I'll plug
it. Oh, I thought we were going.
Yeah, we're going anyway. We're going. I'm with Jay Moore, everybody. He's on the podcast. How you doing, buddy? It's great to talk to you.
Yes. Paul Mercurio interviewing Paul McCartney. That was when the podcast world opened up and said, we are to be taken seriously as a form of media. Exhibit A, Paul and Paul.
Oh, my God. When I was asking him to do it, in my mind, I'm going, the guy's 71. I wonder if he even knows what a podcast is, right? And he's like,
yeah. I'd love to do your podcast, Paul.
Oh, he was amazing, man. And then when he said yes, I turned into... You know, there was that, like, hot girl in, like, high school you always wanted to ask out, but you didn't have the balls to ask her out because she was super hot, and she thought she'd say no, and then you finally say, I'm going to ask her out. She'll say no, and I'll be done with it, but then she says yes, and you're, like, trapped, and you don't know what did. That was me. I was like, he goes, yeah, I'll do it. I'm like, oh, okay. And then he's like, where do you want to do it? I go, and I just blurt out, we're in New York City at the time. I go, I'll fly to London, like that. He's like, what? He's looking at me like, what? And then I get so nervous, I go, you could do it in your... on a phone, on a toilet, naked. I'm like, what the fuck am I saying? And then eventually I pulled my shit together and we worked it out.
Well, it's not, yeah, he is a Beatle, in all fairness to you, Paul. And he's my favorite Beatle, so I was excited about it. And he's an alive Beatle, and that really is.
Right, exactly.
To paraphrase Peter Falk from The In-Laws, are you interested? The key is to enjoy your benefits, but the trick is to not get killed. That really is the key to enjoying your benefits, Joe.
He was like...
He's an alive Beatle.
He was alive, and you know, like... when I was talking to him beforehand, it was just, you know, we're hanging out at the Colbert Report, and the whole time I'm talking to him on the outside, I'm like trying to be cool as a cucumber, and on the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney! I was like one of these, like, 16-year-old girls from the 60s, and I was getting... super close to his face as I was talking to him. I was creeping in closer and closer, like that baboon that cleans ticks off its mates in a National Geographic. It was insanely like, it was just like, it was.
Well, you know, that's the guy you do it to. It's Paul. It's Sir Paul, for crying out loud. It's Get
exactly.
Back. It's Abbey Road. It's all of the above. It's, you know,
yeah.
it's Rocky Raccoon.
It was incredible. Yeah, he was great. But let's talk about you, man. Jay Moore Sports.
Oh, from
Network.
The Beatles.
To Jay
AM
Moore
radio host.
And 9 to 12 Pacific Standard Time, Fox Radio Network, Jay Moore Sports, and more stories. But you and I want folks to know, like, you and I go back to New York and working at the comic strip with Lucian Hold the Boston Comedy Club that was run by Barry Katz. And you always were you had a lot of confidence and you were young. And a buddy of mine in New Jersey who lives like 5 minutes from where you grew up said, I asked Jay about like his days starting out as a teenager at Rascals, because you were kind of a legend of like killing when you were really young. Like, you said you always wanted to be a comic. Like, how, for people that may not know, like, how did you start that early and where'd you get the balls to go do it?
I think, I never fit in anywhere. I was always the guy that was kind of friends with everybody, but not friends with anybody. And I wrestled, and that's kind of a monastic life when you're a wrestler. There's really, you don't have anything in common with anybody ever, because you're spitting into a cup and running. And I always loved comedy. I'd always watch Star Search, and I always watch Evening at the Improv and Evening at Caroline's and stuff. And I would obsess in comedy albums to my brother Russell by Bill Cosby and all that stuff. And
yeah.
Eddie Murphy albums. And I would just memorize them, and I loved them, and I loved comedy, and I couldn't wait for comedy to come on TV. And the one night I was watching, I think it was Star Search, and there was a commercial for public access cable, said it was for Rascals Comedy Club in West Orange, and it said, if you're a comedian between the ages of 13 and 17, we're looking for, you know, to put on a teen stand-up comedy night. And all of a sudden a light bulb went off in my head. It just made me think, oh, that's why I don't fit anywhere, because I'm supposed to be here. And I went in, it was noon on a Sunday, and I didn't drive. I didn't have a driver's license yet. So my friend James Barone drove me noon. Sunday noon in the basement of Rascals Comedy Club. I had to do comedy in front of other 16-year-old wannabe stand-up comedians. Like, probably my first show was the all-time worst audience that ever could have happened, so it worked to my benefit.
Yeah.
But, Paul Mercurio, I'll bring it full circle, when I was there, people said, how are you? Nice to meet you. You know, on Tuesday night, we go over here. And then next Saturday, we go over there. Then all of a sudden, there was like this place to go. And there was a crew to hang out with and a group of people to be with. That's where I fit in. And it was fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I was,
you know, when
way.
You first start doing comedy, all of a sudden everyone's talking about the same places and the same people. Like, all of a sudden you belong. Like, that's the crew you belong to.
Yeah, exactly. And I was the same kid in high school. Like, I was okay at sports and I was a pretty solid student. I was definitely funny and like funny with my friends and stuff like that. And that was kind of my thing. And then I used to like, I remember watching like Rodney on the Tonight Show, and then I'd come in and I'd be doing Rodney to my friends, and they weren't really into comedy that much, and they didn't know I was doing Rodney. They just thought I was funny. And then I was like, oh no, that's just this comedian. And I started to, back then a light bulb went off, but then I took a whole other career path and I did the traditional thing and I went to law school and I was a lawyer. And then you talk about not fitting in, because that was the same feeling I had when I was practicing law. Like, I was doing well, but I didn't feel like I fit in. And then I started to go to these dive bars around New York City after I sold some jokes to Leno. We did them on The Tonight Show. And in a weird way, that's when I started to feel like I fit in. And
Did you ever do any jokes in the courtroom? Like, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, I know you're wondering, like, hey, what's with this guy's shirt?
I did get into a confrontation with a guy on the other side of the table. I had been going to this place. I don't know if he ever did it. It was called Downtown Beirut 2. It was down in the Bowery. It was this real hellhole, like Rick Shapiro used to do it and some of these guys. And I just was getting heckled, like, all get out. And I literally had to go back to the firm and like as I was doing an all-night deal. And I'd go down in a car and I'd take my shirt, my jacket off, and I put like a t-shirt on to look downtown, and then I dress back up in the car and go back. And one night a guy got stabbed and he threw bloody napkins at me and they stuck to my shirt, and I had to go back with a blood stain and on my shirt. And then another night I go back and this dude on the other side of the table is essentially heckling me, saying this document I'd written was a piece of junk. And I literally just blurted out, like, I could have been your father, but the dog beat me over the fence. And the fucking pole room just would, like, nobody knew what to say. Like, I thought I was at a comedy club, and I just blurted out a heckle line against this guy. And it was, like, really, really awkward. But it was, like,
oh,
the same.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they frown on that in the courtroom. There's too much procedure.
Yeah, it's all about,
you know,
like,
what I always hated? You know what I always hated in the courtroom? Is you could say, like, hey, maybe that's why you raped your brother. And then someone will go, I object. And you go, withdrawn. Like, no big deal. Literally, everybody heard it, and it never leaves the jury's consciousness. You can say whatever you want. And I guess that's when you decided to drown your children and light your house on fire. Objection. Okay, withdrawn.
Exactly. And then unfortunately, you can't do that at a club. It's like, no one forgets it when you say it. It's like,
great point. But, yeah, you know, it'd be funny if you still did comedy, and if you still did law and comedy, you could try a case and go, I mean, you know, you did leave the premises, and I do have the 11:15 spot at the Comedy Cellar. What's wrong?
Exactly. Did you, what do you remember the material you were talking about when you were 16, 17, was it 15, whenever that was?
I do, actually. And I remember, what's weird is the material that I remember when I was at Rascals right before it closed, they actually had a VHS tape of me on stage. Mm. And it wasn't the material that I, the material I'm going to tell you that I wrote for Rascals right now is not the material I saw on the videotape. And on the videotape I had that I watched when I was, actually I was 15, I didn't understand what I was saying watching it. Like I didn't, it was like I was watching somebody from another country. I was like, this doesn't, like nothing made sense. I didn't understand any of the references. Right. But I remember it was like, I'm an athlete. I'm on the miniature golf team at school. I was out for the season with an injury. I got hit by a windmill. And then I said, I come from a big showbiz family. My mom's in show business. She's on TV. Chaka from Land of the Lost. Like just, dude, I'm a bedwetter, but I wet the bed from the top of my dresser. My parents think I have a problem. So it's like all like, basically you can only do 3 minutes of bad one-liner jokes right, like that. Right. But then you go to like a club, and you see some guy do 10 minutes and it blows your mind.
Right.
And then you go to another place and you're like, hey, like a friend of yours goes, I'm opening for so-and-so in, you know, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Do you want to come? And you go, sure. And you tag along. And then that headliner does 45 minutes. Right. And you're like, he's a god.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
does he, where does he get it all? He did 20 minutes just about cats.
I'm in and show then, business. I'm at a VFW hall in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We're in show business.
Yeah,
now.
I remember the first time I got paid, Paul, I opened for Sue Ryerson with a comic. And for people listening that don't know, I'm sure you probably explained it, but if you had a car, you could be the opening act for anybody because yep. none of the headliners in Manhattan drove. So you'd have yeah. to go to Manhattan and pick them up and yep. drive them to like Buffalo, New York and back for like $100, but you were just happy for the work.
Right.
And I remember Sue Ryerson, I drove from New Jersey. Where I grew up in Verona, New Jersey, and I drove to Manhattan to pick up Sue Ryerson outside the Improv, and then drove all the way back to New Jersey, past where I lived, to Lake Apacong, and it was a boathouse on the lake in Lake Apacong. I did 10 minutes, and the guy handed me $50, a $50 bill.
Right.
And he said, thanks a lot. That was a lot of fun. And then I drove Sue Ryerson back to Manhattan, then drove back to New Jersey. Then I had first period French at 8 a.m., and I had a $50 bill in my pocket. And I remember I looked at the teacher, and I didn't pay attention to anything. And I thought, I wonder if she has $50 on her, because that's $50 on me. And then I looked around the room, and I'm like, no one in this room has $50 around them but me. And that's really like when a light bulb went off in my head. I had Bootsy Collins on More Stories. And Bootsy Collins said, you know more than anybody, Paul, when you first get paid, it's so much more. Like, you can't explain to people now. Right. Because everybody wants like their own special, their own show. They want to play their kinds of rooms. But you know what it's like to go to dog shit rooms for no money, just to be seen, just so people can see what you have to offer to maybe get invited back. But Bootsy Collins on More Stories podcast said, when they asked James Brown for $300 a week, James Brown said, I'll give you $350. And they left. And he goes, and Bootsy Collins said, it blew our minds. Because back then, that was like $1 million. And then he paused, Paul, and he goes, it was $1 million. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Get paid to play with James Brown. That it was $1 million. To get $150 at a boathouse in New Jersey on a lake. I was like, that was $1 million.
Yeah, and I think, and I don't know if this is for you, but obviously you're very creative. And with me what happened was when I sold Leno that joke, what happened was I was writing jokes as a hobby. And I had like this secret passworded file at my law firm. And I was doing these like huge merger deals, but I would write like on the side. And he was at a private function. And I just went up to him with all these jokes. And I said, look, I don't really need the money. I got a decent job. You want some jokes? And he took it. And he was like, I'll take a look. And then he called me the next day. And he goes, you know, your stuff is clean. And I need stuff for the Tonight Show monologue. If you send something into me and I use it, I'll pay you $50. The next week he called me. He did the joke, $50. And it blew my head off my shoulders. Like, blew my head off my shoulders.
And I was making a lot of joke on TV.
Yeah. He told me
I
got a bottle of champagne with my girlfriend, and we went to another couple's apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And then you had
swinger sex.
And I had swinger sex, and Jay was there, which was awesome. And
he had a car.
And Jay
was amazing how great Jay Leno has been to comedians. Like, has anybody, and I'm being serious, has anybody and real thoughtful, not to get like maudlin or thoughtful anything on the podcast, but it's true. Has anyone in the history, since they first told jokes, helped more comics and been more intrinsically wanting to help other comics more than Jay Leno?
Yeah,
I don't think there is.
I mean, he was totally accessible. He called me himself. He called me himself to tell me he wanted me to start sending material in and that he'd hire me to write for the monologue, and then called me himself when he was going to do it, and then called me again after that. You know, I had him ask him, hey, we want to be on my podcast? I said, sure. Like, he doesn't forget where he came from.
He's same thing. I just asked him to do the podcast. He said yes.
Yeah.
And then I left it alone because I don't want to bother the guy. And the next time I did it tonight, when am I going to be on your podcast? And I was like, this is amazing. This guy's the best.
Yeah, it was crazy. And that, and I think what happened with me, which I think is what you're saying too, is sort of the pet, like, and at least then, and even now to some extent, you almost do it without any pay, because there's that, when he said that joke that I created out of thin air and people reacted to it, it was a feeling that I didn't get from my other job. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when you do a great set, or you have a great radio show or a great performance on TV, you can't describe it to anybody. Then he told me to go out and start trying the jokes out in clubs. And that's when I started to go to these dive bars like downtown Beirut too. And when I got the laugh, it was like a drug injected right into my vein. It was insane. And I remember going, like, I opened for Elaine Boozler, 5 shows up at Joker's Wild in New Haven. If you remember that place.
Who did you open for?
Elaine Boozler, Joker's Wild.
Oh, yeah.
In New Haven. And that place was owned by this guy, John something, who was like a real cokehead. And the guy was notorious for, like, dealing drugs out of the club. And I go in there. And this, the experience you talked about, like going in front of audiences that suck and getting $50 and driving all over the state just to, you know, that all tests you, I think, to see how badly you want it, right? Like on this weekend for me, there was no heat in the club because the guy was so behind on his heat that he wasn't paying his heating bill. He had a show anyway. I walked into the showroom and everybody's sitting in down coats. You could see their breath, and we had to do the show. And I do 5 shows. Right, I do 5 shows. I remember walking in, and he goes, who are you? I go, I'm the MC. He goes, all right, the green room's over there. He goes, you want a shot? I go, maybe later. He goes, you want some pot or some blow? I go, no, I'm good right now. He goes, what are you, a pussy? That's what he said to me. That was the owner.
Oh,
right?
Incredible.
So I go.
You know what's amazing about? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go.
No, I want to hear your story. This is great.
So I go on stage. I do the 5 shows in a jacket. Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I get off stage to get paid. I'm supposed to get paid $250, $50 a set. I drive like 2 hours one way from Manhattan. And he did the classic, the bouncer's there like, yeah, I don't know, the boss is gone. He didn't leave you a check. And he stiffed me on my money for the whole weekend. And then when I went back to get it the following week, I hounded the guy and hounded the guy. And he goes, all right, come back this Saturday. I'll give it to you. I go back. He stiffed me again. He did it to me again. And then when I got him on the phone, he's like, hey, you really think I'm going to pay you? If it comes down to you and the electric company, you lose. You and the oil company, you lose. But I think those moments test you in this to see how badly you want it, you know?
Do you think comics, young comics now have that? Because I don't think they do. I think there's too much... I'm pro-comic. I mean, that's why I started Last Comic Standing, because all my favorite comics nobody had ever heard of.
Right.
Like Bert Kreischer, Ralphie May. I'm like, Dave Attell. Like, those were the funniest guys. Like, who are your favorite comics?
Right.
And nobody knew who they were. But I don't know. There's so many alternative rooms where people can go and do their catered type of show to their catered type of audience. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any comics these days are willing to drive 2.5 hours and get stiff and perform at like bowling alleys in Staten Island for mobsters. I don't know if that happens anymore.
I don't think so. I think part of it too is because of social media and the YouTube and everything else. You know, people can blow up without ever having to leave their neighborhood. You know what I mean? Like, you could just shoot stuff in your apartment, or like, you know, I know comics that have, they call themselves comics that have built a following just because they can do 140 character funny references on Twitter, right? Which I don't think makes you necessarily a comic. I think you got to go out there and work it. And I think that, I think it's like, you know, look, even when we were starting out, right? Like a lot of people were getting development deals and everybody wanted a fast track to their own sitcom, but there ain't no fast track. Like, if you haven't been doing it 5 years and don't have a solid 25 minutes that defines who you are, you can't carry a sitcom for 100 episodes. You can't.
Also, when you and I were doing comedy, if we bombed, the other comics would tell us how bad we bombed.
Right, exactly.
It's like, you, oh, that sucked. And but it was all, it was like a brotherhood. It was, nobody was really like,
I remember one night I was hosting at the Cellar, and I was like, it was, just wasn't going well. And I bring a tell up. You know how like dark and the tell, dark and like Jada tell can be. And he comes on stage and he looks at me and he goes, yeah, good host. And he goes like that. Just like, you know, that. But he was right, though. He was right, you know?
It's hysterical. Good host. Tell. The thing with comedy that is exceptional is, unlike, you know, I do sports talk radio now. I don't care if I'm on TV ever again. I work 15 hours a week. It's great. I've cashed in. I suck from the corporate tip. I don't care. There's a lot of money to be made, and I'm figuring it all out. But the thing with comics, unlike athletes that I see every day and talk to every day, we don't retire. Like, we don't, our hamstrings don't go out. We don't get old. Like, 33 years old in the NFL is old, and you're on the downside of your career. 33 years old, you've been doing comedy 8 years. Like, you're just starting. Yeah. I'm 43 years old, and right now, I'm just starting to do the best comedy. And I'm sure you feel the same way about yourself. You go, okay, like, every year you go, okay, now I'm really cooking.
Yeah.
And then the year after that, you go, wow, really cooking.
I tell you what made me a really strong act in New York City was getting out of New York City and having to go to Iowa and do 7 shows and kill and work through a check spot and do the 3rd show Saturday somewhere where half of them are drunk. Because, you know, part of the problem too is people don't want to go on the road out of LA and New York. And they, you know, it becomes this false sense of security that, hey, I could kill 15 minutes at the Improv or at the Comedy Cellar. So, like, I'm a killer headliner act that can take over a room and crush with 500,000 people. And it's not the same by any stretch of the imagination.
You got to go out. You got to put in the work. And, you know, when I used to get corporate gigs, Paul, I used to panic because I used to go, how the hell am I going to do 45 minutes clean? And then when I had kids, I'm sure you had a similar experience. I had so much material. You can't talk about a 2-year-old and drop like motherfucker and all that shit because it's incongruous and it's weird.
Right.
It's like a tense thing you're talking about. So then all of a sudden you have like 40 minutes of clean material on top of the stuff you were doing for the corporate shows. And then you also need to know, like you said, how to do a check spot. And don't forget the prom shows. How great are the prom shows when they pile 216-year-olds that have drank for the first time into the Boston Comedy Club, somebody vomits, and you got to think on your feet, do I address it, do I not address it? But you got to be able to work all the rooms, you know, private shows for like oil companies. I'm doing a show Friday at a Marine base at 29 Palms. They're actually taking me there by Black Hawk helicopter. Like, it's the weirdest thing in the world. It's great. But the thing with comics, and I didn't even think about it, so you and I just started talking about like these check spots and stuff, is we don't have like a downside in our career. If you go see Bill Cosby, like when he's just on Comedy Central, it was great. Like, you're watching a master.
Yeah.
And like Carlin's last special before he died was one of his best specials. And to quote The Who, he died before he got old.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And unfortunately, I think the business is a little better, like from the suit side, the network side of looking at it that way a little bit. Cause there's always this sort of desire to push youth. But, you know, I don't want to mention any names, but we both know comics that got development deals really early, big ones, $500,000 development deals, didn't go anywhere. Their agents and their managers cast them aside, and they end up on the roadside with no direction and no focus. Sometimes it's better to know when not to go than when to go, you know. And, you know, what I find is, like, the people that are the best are the ones that define themselves whenever that is. And I don't think age matters. Like, if it's funny, somebody's going to watch it. It doesn't matter if the guy's got a little gray hair or a bald spot or if the chick is a little heavy or whatever. It's like if it's funny, you're going to watch it. And I think it's hopefully getting a little better. I don't know. I don't know if you feel like the business is still like youth-centric or not.
Well, it'll always be youth-centric because the youth are the ones that can spend the longest. So if Tide has a commercial and a sitcom and they know 18-year-olds are watching, that's always what they're going to drive for, because 18-year-olds are going to spend money for 50 years as opposed to a 50-year-old who's going to spend it for 30, you know, God willing. But it's true what you said. And it's also like, Louis Anderson told me this once, and I didn't even really know what he was talking about, but at the time I was like, oh, that kind of came out of nowhere. But he just pulled me aside once, and he's like a real sweet, sweet guy, and he goes, if you're funny, no one can ever take it from you.
Yeah.
Never. Yeah. No matter what happens, if you're funny and you put in the work, nobody can ever take it from you. Yeah. And you realize, like what you just said, if you or I have like a development deal, I'm not saying we're like who we are, hoity-toity, I'm just saying we put in the work. But if guys like you or I are like a tell, like if you don't have a development deal or if it all caves through, you pick up the phone, you go back to the clubs, and because that's right. what you do best. And right. it's like the greatest, most lucrative safety net ever.
Yeah, the other thing that Jon Stewart said is write, because if you can write, you can always have a job too. He said, be a good writer, have that in your hip pocket, whether it's for yourself or other people, whether it's for TV or whatever, What is it that you found? Because I think when you start out in stand-up, you're doing an act. And then at some point, it's such a weird environment to be in. First of all, you go up on stage in front of a group of strangers and immediately got to get them
the number one fear in the world, standing in front of strangers.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that in a second, because I know that feeling that you have of panic or stage fright, because even though you do it for a long time, sometimes you just feel like, oh, can I do it again? But when was the point, and I know there has to be a point for you, people need to know, like early on, Jay was so confident, and still are to this day, obviously, but confident beyond your years, and that you had a lot of buzz early and all deserve it, and you got Saturday Night Live. You were just charismatic on stage to watch. I was into you. I wanted to fuck you right there. I said it, okay? You got it out of me, okay?
Though? I've learned from having my own podcast and talking to other comics, that confidence, people really just thought I was an asshole. I didn't realize, because I don't have the self-loathing and the crippling depression that comics have.
I never felt you were an asshole. I just, you're a nice guy, and we would, shoot the shit and hang out.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah.
That's what I thought too. But apparently when you walk into a room uber confident and start breaking balls, some people are like, this guy sucks.
He's yeah, but you know dick. What that also might be was you got a lot of stuff young, and there may be jealousy factored in there. Let's
not my fault. Out. Go on.
No, I know. I'm not.
You got it. Now, no, I'm not saying that to you. I'm saying it to the other people that had a problem with it. Like, you go nail your audition, and don't get mad at me because I nailed mine.
Exactly. Well,
when you were talking about panic attacks on stage, and I had panic disorder on Saturday Night Live. I was diagnosed with panic disorder, and you're dying. And people that go, I think I've had a panic attack. You haven't had a panic attack. If you've had panic attacks, you are dying. Your insides have to be on your outsides. It's inexplicable. And I won't get technical.
Can I just ask you, physically, do you start breathing heavy? Can you not move? Are you shivering? Are you shaking?
I don't know how else to put it, except you're dying. Your heart rate is like 160 for no reason. You can't breathe. You think you're going to pass out. You get complete vertigo, weird colors, and it's almost like it's exactly like a bad acid trip where you're like, get that towel out of here. I hate that towel. Like, just weird stuff sets you up.
Right.
And not to get too technical, but a very layman's way, I had a great doctor, and she told me it's a neurological glitch. Your body is releasing endorphins and adrenaline at life-saving levels for no reason. That's exactly what a panic attack is. Anxiety is, your boss is an asshole every day, and when you drive to work, you get anxiety because you got to see that guy that's an asshole every day. That's stimulus response. That's right. The difference between the two. There's no rationale to panic.
So let me ask you something, because when I read this about you and knew this, and I'm glad we're talking about it. Going back to what we were just talking about, you as a performer and as a guy off stage, like the last person in the world you'd peg as a guy would have a panic attack. And good for you for talking about it and writing about it in your book. It's a great book and people should get it. When did this, was this always the case, even when you were working the clubs with us in the city, or did it kick in when you were on SNL, or what triggered
it? It kicked in on SNL. Saturday Night Live is when it kicked in, and I caught it early. And Sarah Silverman, I went to her because we were sharing a dressing room one show night. And I said to her, I'm dying, I'm dying, I'm dying, I'm dying. And she said, you're having a panic attack. I've had them. Here's the phone number to my doctor. She saved my life. And the doctor's name was Noelle Taylor. It still is, I would hope. she became Muslim. She's not Kareem Abdul-Taylor. And no, I'm really, that's still her name.
Is it really?
So I called the doctor. No, it's Noelle Taylor. I called the doctor, and she actually called me back within the hour and said, it sounds like you have a classic case of panic disorder. You're not dying. No one has ever died from a panic attack. I can see you tomorrow at my office, which was a Sunday, and we'll talk. And I went and I met her, and she diagnosed me correctly, went through the symptoms, and she prescribed me Klonopin, 1 milligram in the morning, 1 milligram at night. And she said, let me know how this works for you, and then I'll see you in about 4 days. We'll figure out what to do from there. So I took two, she said, take two to start right away. I took two Klonopin, I went home, and about 3 hours later, I slept for 6 hours in the middle of the day, because I think my body was just let off the hook and finally able to relax. And then I went back to the doctor, and I said, it worked. And she goes, okay, good, just call me when you need refills. And I was like, well, don't you want to get into my childhood? Don't you want? She goes, I don't want to do, and this were her exact words. She said, that's old psychiatry. It's called, it's like an archaeological dig. And I think it does more harm than good. If you came in here from bronchitis and I gave you an inhaler, I wouldn't ask you about your parents to ask you why you have bronchitis. Who cares? We fixed it. Let's keep moving forward. And I'm still on the same dosage of Klonopin. But I used to get panic attacks. When I met my wife, Nick, my second wife, the good one, I was going, what happened was I met the love of my life and I was going on stage. And in my first marriage, I was gross. I cheated. I was venal. It was just, I was not a good person.
You were drinking at the time, right?
A lot. Yeah. And it was just, it wasn't good. And when I wasn't drinking, I was a dry drunk. And you can look that up on Google. It's too much of an explanation to get sidetracked. It was very much a dry drunk in my behavior every day. It was very alcoholic behavior, even if I wasn't drinking. And then I was on stage at the Brea Improv in Brea, California, and just lights out panic, like fucking holy shit, I'm dying. And now, but I've had panic disorder, you know, for 8 years, been medicated. I mean, I'm flying on prop planes. I'm on Nemo submarine. Nothing bothers me. Right. And all of a sudden in the middle of a show, I am dying.
In the middle of the show, you're on stage,
right in the middle. I'm on stage. And I all of a sudden just, a switch goes off.
Okay, let me ask you something. Is the panic like, oh my God, they're not going to like me? Is it that, you know,
no,
sometimes you get that feeling like, can I do
none
this
of that.
Again? Is this crowd going to like
you,
me?
If you were on a sub, if your body's a submarine and there's a hatch and you're underneath the water and you open that hatch, how that water would flood the submarine, it's just that inside your body with adrenaline and endorphins for no reason whatsoever. And my doctor told me panic attacks are most common with actors and interns at hospitals, people that go from structure to no structure. On Saturday Night Live, there was no structure. I just want to be told what time to come in and what time to leave. And everyone was just happy sitting around talking fucking all night. It made me crazy. And interns at hospitals, you go from like med school to all of a sudden, you know, you're at a triage and there's a guy with a bullet hole because he shot when Paul Mercurio was in court. Bring it all around, Paul
Mercurio.
There
you go, baby. That's what I'm talking about. You can only do that if you work the road. You can only do that if you work little
clubs.
Only you could pull that off.
This is why I had the panic attack. And I spoke to my wife about it because it really is a case of my better half. Like, she's incredible. And I told her I was having a panic attack. And she said, why don't you just take some time off? And then when you go back, she said, you can afford it. You're working. I think I was on Ghost Whisperer at the time. And she said, you're working, you can afford it, just take some time off. And then when you do go back, you'll just tell the truth. And you just tell stories about yourself. And I went, okay. And I didn't go on stage for 2 years. And I realized, I know now what it was, what the panic was. I had met the love of my life and, like, you know, infidelity and lying and steal, all that shit went out the window. It was game over. However, that guy that was unhappy, that dry drunk, that alcoholic in the first marriage that was like an asshole, that was the act that I had. So my life changed when I met my wife. I became my true, you know, the guy you want to be, the guy you can be proud of at the end of the day. But to do my act, to go on stage, I had, it's like a, okay, like a snake that sheds its skin.
Yeah,
I had to go get that skin and bring it on stage to make money. And it was disgusting.
Yeah.
But my wife was right. I took 2 years off. I went on stage and I just started telling stories. My whole act now is just stuff that's happened to me.
Well, I mean, that's really fascinating to me, because one of the things I wanted to ask you was, like, where was that place where you went from, quote unquote, having an act to being who you are on stage, which I think is the biggest and most important transition for a comic to do as a true artist. You know, there's some guys that have great, quote unquote, acts. They do a bunch of misdirection jokes or, you know, whatever. And you laugh for 20 minutes or an hour, but you never walk away feeling like you really know that person. Kind of like, I call it like McDonald's comedy. Like, you just ate, but then you're hungry 10 minutes after you eat. You know what I mean? It doesn't fill you up. Whereas if you watch a Pryor or
I know. Carl, yeah, I know exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah, that was.
Was it that break of 2 years where you stopped doing a quote unquote an act, or that guy that you were doing before that was actually who you were though too, in a way, right?
No, it wasn't who I was, because, like I said, I was a dry drunk, and my whole act, all I wanted to do after the show was get drunk, get higher, get laid. So everything in my act was like little like laying cheese out for a rat. Like, I'd lay little references to where I was staying. You know, I would actually say the name of the hotel. I'd mention, like, you know, when you do a little bit of coke or you do a little bit of booze, you know, you get high, you know, you're smoking grass, you know, I don't know where you get grass in Phoenix. How would I know? You know, just every single thing I did, you know, I'd be humping the stool, hoping somebody was like, nice move. I should have sex with that guy. And it was just gross. Like, none of it was me. It was just all about what was going to happen after the show. And it took me 22, I've been doing comedy 28 years. So for 23 years, it was about 23 and a half years where I went on stage and just simply spoke. And there's no act.
So, and it's fascinating. But don't you think part of the reason for that behavior is because you did start as a kid and you grew up, and your growth was stilted in that area of your life where you started at 15. So that's kind of where we're all 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. That's what we think about, getting laid and getting drunk. And you weren't allowed to grow out of that because you were like in this bubble of entertainment.
Yeah, I do. And I also think it's a lot like music, where you have to know the rules to break them. Like, when you listen to, like, jazz and Ornette Coleman or, like, John Coltrane just lose their fucking minds on some weird solo, and you're like, whoa, that guy, he's, like, completely off the charts. And you're like, no, not really. Like, that guy knows all the bars inside and out because they did all their work. So you got to know the rules before you can break them. So by doing all those shows, even though I was putting on an act, just the stage time alone, I was comfortable with the pauses. And that was the huge... Yeah. That was the biggest thing for me as a stand-up comic, standing on stage when it's quiet and not freaking out that I have to fill it.
Yep. And not just for you, for anybody. It's, you know, look, and they call it in sports, let the game come to you. And when you do that, it's like a woman. Like, if you try too hard with the audience, to me, is like a woman. If you try too hard, like that you need them too much, they're going to push you away. But you also can't be like such an asshole that you push them away. You have to find that right middle ground. And I totally agree with you. Like, to sit there and have the confidence, and it only comes from doing every single gig, from the shit gigs that we used to do when we were open acts to, you know, corporate gigs for thousands of dollars, to have that life experience where you go, I've been here and I've done this before. There's nothing that's going to shake my confidence, right? I mean, Andrew Luck's going to have a better shot this time around in the playoffs because he's been through it once already, right? I mean, he's going up against
the same. And he played all 4 years of college and he never missed a game. And
right.
Also, when you let there be pauses, the pauses make the symphony, the old expression goes. And when you let there be pauses and you let it get quiet, everybody kind of leans in. Everybody leans towards you.
Yeah.
Instead of like hitting them over the fucking head, like joke. It's like, Jesus Christ. Enough, Nolan Ryan. We get it. You got fastballs. Relax. Throw it. Mix in a curve. You know, waste one. Bounce one in the dirt. He might swing at it.
So how scary was it that first time after the 2 year break that you went up and started to, you know, because in this conversation, I mean, honestly, I'm getting chills because a lot of the stuff you say resonates with me and hopefully a lot of people listening, because I think it applies to life in general. Is just live your life honestly and you're going to be a more peaceful person. How scary was it to come out and do a non-act act and be you?
It wasn't scary because you know this feeling as well as anybody. When you have new stuff, you can't wait to go on stage and do it.
Yeah.
And when people go, I'm going to go on and work out some new stuff, I don't really understand it, because if you've been doing comedy 20 years, you know if it's going to work or not before you even go. Like last night I was at the Improv in Hollywood and I did about 20 minutes. And I'm not like tooting my own horn. It's just you and I talking shop.
Yeah.
But like I had 20 minutes of new stuff. The only reason I'm saying it is because I know it's funny. That's why I can't wait to get there because I'm like, yeah. Oh my God, this will kill.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
By the time I went on, I had so much material. I had had a kid. I was in love. I could talk about stuff that I knew about. So I wasn't afraid because I wanted to go up. Instead of going up and pushing it at them and hard selling it, I wanted to go up and share it.
Yeah.
And that might sound kind of like, you know, creepy
no.
and like
actually. No.
It is honestly how I felt. Like, these are really funny stories. And it doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, the Christopher Walken stuff and the Pacino stuff and the Tracy Morgan stuff, like that all, like, you know, Christopher Walken did ask me, like, what happened to your dog's tail? Like, you know that's going to work if you can do a Christopher Walken impression.
Right.
And it takes like 11 minutes to get the full long version of the Christopher, your dog, right. What happened to your dog's tail? Where did it go? Like, he was genuinely, like, flummoxed that I had a dog with no tail. It would be, and then he kept going. And I think, and this is, George Carlin said this in his book that was released posthumously, and it's called Last Words.
Mm-hmm.
He said, comics, it's really our job just to have our radar tuned differently to the GP, to the general population. Like, we have radar, like, what Carlin said was certain phrases, certain words, certain situations, and mostly comparative comedy, like, over here it's like this and over here it's like that.
Mm.
That's everybody thinks it, but comics are the only ones whose radar is zeroed in on it, and then we then have the opportunity to make it funny and reproduce it and share it.
Yeah. I mean, I say on stage it's the last bastion of unedited speech, right? You go up and say whatever you want, do whatever act you want, and the people vote with their dollars and the club votes with their dollars, right? The club doesn't have you back if you don't do well. If you do well, they like you, they have you back, and it's very pure.
Yeah, but if the guy doesn't have heat, you can't judge yourself on that guy.
Exactly. It's a little hard. Exactly. Listen, I want to do another one of these with you because there's a whole bunch of other stuff I want to get into with you, like your sports comedy career, which I have always admired, and what you're doing with the radio show and so can down the road, can I get you on and do another one of these with you? Because this has been,
yeah, no, I would love to. I've been at the carpool lane in my kid's preschool right now watching them play. And
oh,
I was like, oh, my God, I want to come back on again because I love talking about comedy. And
yeah.
I love talking about comedy with people that are as passionate about it as you are.
Yeah.
And
no,
it's fun. And there's no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts. You've got to put in the work. And
well,
you
but it's
do it, and you're gonna fail
like a real
a lot,
artist
but...
But you're a real artist because you're finding your way, like, and that's like this is never done. Like that's the
no,
like that's the one thing about this that sometimes for me is maddening in a way. Like, you know, I worked as a lawyer. Like you were done. Like you had a deal. I was doing M&A deals. We were selling companies to each other. You had a deal, and it was a closing date of September 1st, and you closed it on September 1st. You had a closing dinner, and you moved on to the next thing. This is like the joke's never fucking done. The act is never done. You could always go deeper. You could always cut yourself open more. Like, but it's maddening,
yeah.
And it's exhilarating at the same time.
I give a perfect example. Anybody listening to this podcast that is not a comic, everyone's had a conversation with somebody like in an elevator or at a party, and someone's either like put you down or had some great point, and then like the next day you think of that conversation, you go, oh, fuck, why didn't I just tell him that? That would have shut him down. That's what comics think every 20 minutes. That's why
right.
We can't wait to get back at it. We're never done.
Exactly.
And it's about old-ass jokes. Sometimes what the audience doesn't know is your new stuff is just shit you haven't done in 14 years, and you just thought of like 14 new tags for three old jokes.
Exactly. Do you ever have a time when you, like, I've talked to Lewis Black about this, like, you do a joke for the first time, it's like, it crushes, it's great. Then the second and the third time you do it, it
doesn't
do as
work.
Well. And then it takes like a little while to get back to get it to, why do you think that is?
I think Buddy Hackett asked me once, what's your monitor on stage? And I said, I didn't know what he meant. And I asked him what my monitor was. And he said, your monitor is every thought in your head that isn't what you're saying at that exact moment. why isn't this guy laughing? Why do I hear them taking ice out of the ice machine? How long have I been on? Are these lights too bright? I think I have to go to the bathroom. Like, every single thought that's not what you're saying is your monitor. Mm-hmm. So if you are just completely like jazz, free flowing, riffing off the cuff, you're at zero. And then
which is ideally where you want to be.
Right. But here's what's hysterical. I asked Buddy Hackett, I think I said at the time 30, but I know now I was really like at 70 and now I'm probably at 30. And he goes, that's good. For as long as you've been doing comedy, 30, that's not bad. And then I asked Buddy Hackett, I go, what's your monitor? And I assumed wouldn't you assume his number would be zero?
Yeah.
He goes, one. And I go, why one? He goes, I've got to know where the fire exits are. But after that, I give him 100% of 99% for the whole time.
That is hilarious. But he's right. You got to be at zero. Listen, people can see you on the 17th at the Irvine Improv, right? You're doing a show there?
Yeah. And then in Las Vegas at South Point Casino. Just go to jmoore.com if you want any of my dates. And if you really want to help out, you listen to my podcast. There's an app, a More Stories app. Wherever you go get Angry Birds, that's the place you would get my apps. Type in More Stories, M-O-H-R. And, bro, we got to do this again. This is great. And when are you? You're in New York, right?
I'm in New York, but I'm going to be coming back out to L.A. In a couple of weeks. So
I'm there Super Bowl week. So let's definitely do the podcast when I'm there too.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome.
We can do it twice either.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to see you when
my man.
Jay Moore Sports is on Fox Radio Network 9 to 12 Pacific Standard Time.
Who cares? Let's pump the podcast. It's a podcast world.
Podcast.
Let's do it in honor of Sir Paul.
There you go. You're the best.
Just don't forget what Tracy Morgan said, and that is, you got to get everybody pregnant.
All right. Hope you enjoyed Jay Moore. Funny, honest. I didn't know some of that stuff about the panic attacks. Really cool. Once again, December 15th to the 18th, Omaha Funny Bone. I'm headlining. Come on out. Have some laughs. December 15th to the 18th, Omaha Funny Bone, and go to Omaha Funny Bone's website for tickets. Have a great holiday. See you next week.